Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. President Trump has made his feelings about US competition with China plain. One of the early acts of his second presidential term has been to place tariffs on Chinese imports. China has since responded with its own tariffs on certain US goods and restrictions on the imports of certain minerals. To talk about US-China relations with the return of Donald Trump, in February 2025, I spoke to Professor Ming-Hsin Pei. He is the Tom and Margot Pritzker 72 Professor of Government and George R. Roberts Fellow at Claremont McKenna College. Professor Pei is an expert on US-China relations, state surveillance, and Chinese governance and economic policy. His latest book is The Sentinel State, Surveillance and the Survival of Dictatorship in China. We also spoke about China's surveillance state and the concept of preventative repression, and how China might respond to US escalation on trade. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on The Ballpark today. Could you start by just briefly introducing yourself and your research to our audience, please?
Okay, I'm a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, which is a liberal arts college in Southern California. My research focuses on Chinese domestic politics, US-China relations, and transition to democracy. So that's sort of my academic interest, obviously. I also watched China's foreign policy and changes in East Asia's geopolitical dynamics.
So your latest book, The Sentinel State, examines the evolution and operation of China's surveillance state. Can you talk a bit about what inspired you to write this book, and what are your most important takeaways about state surveillance and the Chinese Communist Party's grip on power?
A few years ago, I became aware that most of the discussion, especially in the popular media, of China's surveillance tended to focus overwhelmingly on China's use of high technology. And as somebody who grew up in China, I knew that China's surveillance was pretty robust and sophisticated and pretty effective, even in the days when China was very poor and there was not very much technology for the Chinese government to use. So based on that hunch, I told myself there must be something wrong about this conventional wisdom that is China's surveillance is based on high tech. And then I began to look. The initial assumption is that tech is powerful, but tech is not everything. Or labor, organization, tactics also play a very important role in maintaining effective surveillance on a very large society. So after looking at a lot of official records, documents, I came up with this argument. That is, the secret to China's surveillance is not technology, but organization. The Chinese government relies a lot more on organization. Practically speaking, they use a lot more informants than we previously realized. They have very carefully compiled lists of targets, people they want to watch, and they have a top-down command system that coordinates various surveillance tasks. So that is the basic argument. Tech in China came into the picture relatively late. We're talking about the last 15 years or so. Before that, China had a very primitive technological setup for its surveillance system. But even that, China had a very robust surveillance system. So now the combination of top-line organization and the top-line technology makes the Chinese surveillance system really extraordinarily effective.
So you argue that China's surveillance system employs preventive repression, which combines traditional methods of surveillance with advanced technology. Can you talk about what you mean by this and how it has enabled the CCP to maintain power during periods of rapid socioeconomic change?
When we think about repression, we normally associate repression with reactive repression or expose repression, that is, after an act of resistance has happened, the regime or the political elites in the authoritarian regime respond by arresting the participants in the protest, its leaders. So that is all using violence in the process. So that is what we associate. That's what the image of repression is. But repression is another kind of repression. That is, regime can prevent an act of protest or an act of defiance from taking place by learning the intentions or by isolating people who are most likely to engage in such acts or by intimidating them to tell them that the government actually knows what they're up to. So that is preventive repression. So let me just give you a simple example in the Chinese context. June 4th, 1989, when the Chinese government is sending the troops to crack down peaceful protesters. That is an act of reactive repression. That is, the protesters had been on Tiananmen Square for more than a month. The government did not know anything about the protests before they began, so it had to use a large number of troops to kill quite a few people, and caused a huge reputational damage, huge political crisis for China. So reactive repression is very costly for a regime. So if a regime can actually prevent an act of mass resistance or protest from taking place, it's less costly, less dangerous for the regime. So preventive repression involves surveillance. That is, how do you prevent people from actually taking part in a large-scale protest? And then you use informants, you use wiretaps, you use surveillance cameras. So the most remarkable thing about China since June 4th, 1989, we're talking about almost 36 years, that is, no such large-scale protest has taken place. And I argue that one of the reasons is that the Chinese Communist Party has gradually and then systematically improved its capacity to maintain constant surveillance and preventive repression on its own people.
So I'll just ask a follow-up question, if I may. So you would characterize this preventive repression as being pretty effective for the last 30 years or thereabouts?
That is, if you know who your likely enemies are, who their leaders are, then you watch them and you make sure they know they are watched. That is the key about preventive repression. So you can get advanced warnings about their activities, tensions, who their friends are, who the network is, their main means of communication. Then you control these people without having to arrest them after they engage in a very public act of resistance.
And this preventive repression, is it mostly domestic or does it extend internationally in terms of if anyone internationally wants to influence things within China as well?
I've read reports, so-called transnational repression. My book does not deal with that aspect, largely because as a scholar, you base your research or your findings on the basis of documented evidence. In my own research, I did not see such evidence. This does not mean that these activities do not exist. It's very possible that they are highly classified, that the kind of open source materials I looked at did not contain them.
How have strategies of surveillance been employed by other authoritarian regimes? Do you see parallels in democratic countries in how they use technology for surveillance or social control?
The first part of the question is, other authoritarian regimes have also employed surveillance. I think before the end of the Cold War, Stasi, the German secret police, was considered the gold standard because they have informants. They did not have a lot of modern technology. So I looked in my research, I looked at Stasi. What I found is that Stasi employed a lot of secret agents as well as informants. The difference between Stasi and China today is that in terms of the number of informants they employ, roughly the same, about 1% of the population. So for Chinese, we're talking about 10 million, 15 million people. For Stasi, because Stasi, East Germany is about 15 million people, so it's 150,000. That's a lot, right? But what Stasi did that was very different from China is that Stasi had a lot of people on its payroll. Stasi had about 90,000 people on its payroll as sort of formal agents of the secret police, 1989. But Stasi did both domestic spying and external espionage. China's secret police has two units, the one that does domestic spying and the one that does external espionage. But these two units are separated in terms of their organization. One is part of the Ministry of Public Security. The other is the Ministry of State Security. So if you use the Stasi ratio, which is something like 0.7% of the population, China would have 8 million, if you use the Stasi ratio, 8 million secret agents responsible for domestic spying and external espionage. As far as I know, China does not have that many. So in other words, China works with a lot fewer uniformed police or secret police agents. That's because China has a lot fewer resources. And also China relies a lot more on bureaucratic organization to maintain surveillance. So this is one extreme, a communist regime. Most other authoritarian systems have much less effective surveillance. That's not just because they are poorer, less technologically advanced, but also because they don't have the same kind of bureaucratic political organization as China does. China's regime, the Communist Party, is a Leninist party. A Leninist party is different from what I would call garden variety dictatorships, in that it has organizational presence everywhere in a society, in factories, universities, schools, neighborhoods, villages. So it can rely on the party to maintain preventive repression. Other dictatorships simply do not have that kind of organizational capability or penetration of society. So this is democratic society. Technologically, what China has probably is no different from what the US has, what the UK has. The key difference is that the technological surveillance in the West, in democratic societies, is used exclusively, if not mostly, for law enforcement. For political purposes, so far, we're not there yet. It may change. But right now, surveillance in the West, the use of informants, I've looked at this also quite carefully. The law enforcement agencies in the West also use a lot of informants. But those informants are tasked to penetrate criminal organizations or report on other crimes. So it's, again, law enforcement, not political spy.
You're giving a U.S.-China seminar here at the Phelan U.S. Center with the title Escalation or Stabilization, U.S.-China Relations Under a New Administration in Washington. And so I think it would be interesting to talk about some recent developments that have happened as almost as we record this podcast, really. Following his return to the White House, Donald Trump has announced a raft of tariffs against Canada, Mexico, and 10 and 15% tariffs on coal, oil, natural gas, and some vehicles from China. In response, China has announced new export controls against the U.S. for metal products, I think. What does the administration's beginnings in terms of thinking about tariffs against China and others say about its likely relationship with China going forward?
Well, it's still highly uncertain. 10% tariffs Trump has placed on China have nothing to do with trade, because it's a punitive measure to pressure China on the fentanyl issue. That is, China is being blamed for not stopping its precursor chemicals from being shipped or sold to Mexico, which is now turned into fentanyl pills. So that is the official excuse or reason cited by Trump in imposing the first 10% tariffs. China has retaliated, but China's retaliation is seen by people who know the specifics as mainly symbolic, because it affects something like $12 billion of U.S. exports to China. Trump's 10% affects $500 billion of exports from China to the U.S. So we're talking about two, so totally different categories of goods, the share of the trade that will be affected. Whether that will escalate or not, we will have to wait and see, because it's highly likely that Trump himself, because this is all now dumped and decided by Trump, views this as unacceptable. He might want to escalate 25%, or he might want to do what he has done with Canada and Mexico. Let's talk about what to do, right? At this moment, the biggest puzzle is that what exactly does Trump want? We know that China does not want to escalate. Timing is bad. The Chinese economy is in a slump. A trade war is the last thing they want. But, you know, this is not exactly China's decision to make. It's a decision that Washington has to make as well. So I would say that the opening salvo spells some trouble, but we should not, at this moment, rule out the possibility that some kind of compromise can still be worked out.
So you say that China doesn't want to escalate and doesn't seem to be in a position where it can or should do so. What do you think will happen if Trump wants to escalate?
I think it really depends on what Trump wants. As escalation for escalation's sake could be a reason. We're talking about serious consequences for both sides. It's not that trade war helps the U.S. The trade war actually hurts both sides. Prices will go up. If Trump's counterterms are more or less acceptable and practical, that is, these are things that I've read in the press. He may want a deal on TikTok. He may want China to agree to export the secret sauce, the algorithms that sort of keep users engaged on TikTok. He may want China to fulfill the so-called terms of the phase one deal struck in January 2020. China bought like 60% of the $200 billion. So there's something like $80 billion. So these things are sort of workable. And the China may say, well, maybe you can give us something too, less export control. So if engage each other in a pragmatic mode is a give and take, then some deal can be worked out. But if it is if Trump proposes no terms, then how do you deal with this? Right. So then China will have to live with this. Actually, China has been reorienting its economy away from the U.S. To suit countries. China is still exporting a lot. Last year, China's export surplus, trade surplus, almost $1 trillion, which means that China still makes a lot of stuff. The stuff probably, and a lot of that ends up in the U.S., except through a third country. So China, in terms of dealing with tariff wars, it has more experience today than 2018. But still, China would like a deal if a deal can be got. Difficulty for Trump is that he will have to know what he wants. Right now, we don't. And another complicating factor is that Trump is surrounded by China hawks, by the people who simply don't want any deal with China. They just want to cut off China from trading with the U.S. And that would be another factor we have to think about.
President Trump has recently extended the deadline for TikTok to localize data storage or to restructure its operations. How do you think this reflects the broader technology rivalry between the U.S. and China?
TikTok probably is now not the most important rivalry. I think the TikTok has captured headlines largely because so many people in the West use it. In terms of its technological sophistication and future security, geopolitical implication, TikTok, in my judgment, should not be considered extremely important. The much more serious rivalry is actually DeepSeek, this AI company that came from nowhere to capture headlines. TikTok, a lot of things have been said about TikTok. But when you look at the pure technological aspect, it's only about its algorithm. How do you keep people sort of addicted to this particular app? And I don't think it's a very profound kind of technology. On the other hand, DeepSeek is truly innovative because we don't know whether sort of its claims have been sort of contested, but if press reports are correct, this is what we know. It's as capable as, or nearly as capable as, the best American large language models out there, but it's cost hundreds or even less of the US cost and uses a lot less advanced chips, a lot fewer of them. So if that is true, then I think the implications are vast. That is, US export control is not as effective as people think, and then export control may actually produce unintended consequences, forcing China to be a lot more creative. And then if this kind of technology has wide application, then people would use this as open source technology. So going forward, other countries will use a form of a platform, a kind of approach that is not American. So that's, I think, why DeepSeek story is a much bigger story than the TikTok story.
There have been concerns over Chinese data collection for TikTok, and I think probably for DeepSeek as well now. Do these concerns revolve around fears of Chinese state surveillance? And are there any other concerns?
These concerns are very legitimate. But so far, we just don't have any evidence that sort of the data collected by these platforms or apps are being used by China to surveil Western users. Based on my knowledge, probably China does not have a lot of political reasons to surveil people who normally have nothing to do with China, like teenagers on TikTok. Why would China be interested in what they do? But, you know, these things, because China is China and it's a geopolitical rival of the US, people in the US are justified in just raising concerns. But concerns is one thing. You need evidence. And on the other hand, data, the biggest violators of data privacy are actually American firms. They collect data, they sell them to brokers. And if you want to protect average citizen in the West, you've got to strengthen data protection laws. And that's the first step, of course, dealing with Chinese apps. You should be a little bit more vigilant.
So in a 2019 article, you noted that many commentators frame US-China competition in terms of what's known as a Thucydides trap, which is when an emerging power, in this case China, threatens an established one, like the US. And then this often inevitably leads to war or conflict. With recent media focus attending to artificial intelligence and chip manufacturing, are these developments part of a truly zero-sum race?
I think they should not be zero-sum race because there can be a lot more mutually beneficial cooperation between China and the US. But when they see each other as existential threats, then of course, everything becomes zero-sum. And at the moment, I think we are seeing zero-sum competition in artificial intelligence, in semiconductors. The two are obviously connected. And even in climate change, that's very tragic because we are talking about Thucydides trap. I'm sure when the term was coined, there was no such thing as a common threat to humanity, that is climate change. Now we are in this era. So if two great powers do not cooperate because of their geopolitical rivalry on dealing with climate change, then the chances that the world can actually reduce carbon emissions and bring down global temperature, that prospect is very low.
Thinking about some of the global challenges you mentioned, like climate change, and many believe that AI is indeed a global challenge, what would you say are the biggest factors preventing cooperation between the US and China? Is it just political? Is it national interest?
Political considerations determine national interest. That is, I don't want to trade with you because your power will threaten me. I mean, this is national interest. That determination, that national interest is framed in terms of a threat perception. I think today it's just lack of trust in each other and the determination by elites in both countries. They are locked in the suit, in a suit. See, it is a trap for global primacy. The one side's gain is the other side's loss is totally zero sum. So that's, I think, the collaboration on AI, on global climate change is so difficult today.
So during Trump's first term, you critiqued its America First policy for alienating traditional allies. How do you think these traditional allies will respond to the return of what are quite protectionist policies? Does Trump's second term mean that they might be better prepared and know what to expect?
Judging by recent reactions to Trump's threats or actual use of tariffs, I don't think Western allies are that prepared because we don't see a plan, right? We see a lot of loose talks. My judgment is that they just want to play for time. They think 4 years, they just get through 4 years without things blowing up in their face. So they would do whatever they can first to mollify Trump, to see if he just wants some kind of deal that would make him look good. But they just don't want Western allies. They are caught in a difficult position because without U.S. support, they would have to swim alone in a very dangerous, uncertain world. So this, whatever they do, they still want to preserve their relationship with the U.S. And whatever Trump does, they would try to humor him. They try to make sure that they would not destroy the relationship.
So with your extensive work on governance, surveillance, and international relations, what advice would you offer policymakers navigating current U.S.-China relations?
It's hard. My advice is that most of trade issues deals with give and take. Compromise is still possible. If you can somehow separate trade from geopolitics, it's very hard to do. If you can do your best to separate, then trade will not be the issue that will lead to the next great power war. I think we need to pay a lot more attention to security, to military competition, to potential flashpoints that could get China and the US into a shooting scenario. If you avoid a shooting scenario, then it's a lot easier to repair the relationship. I'm not saying that it is easy to repair the relationship. It would be easier to repair a relationship if you don't have direct military conflict. So people who work toward that goal, that is where not, the upside is very limited in China's relationship with the US, which we should not expect rapprochement. Past experience tells us this is a generational conflict or rivalry. But if we can build a floor to this relationship, then we should all be very, very lucky.
And so thinking about that US-China relationship, what should our listeners be looking out for over the coming year or so in that relationship?
1 year is too long. I think we should look at the sort of the next 3 months, first 6 months would be critical, whether they actually find a flaw before the flaw falls out. So now we'll see whether the trade war escalates. If the trade war it's at the very, very beginning stage. Both sides show flexibility. So that's very good news. And then we see whether high-level exchanges take place, especially leadership level. So Trump goes to China or Xi comes to the U.S. So that's another thing to watch. And then so minister-level exchanges, are they taking place? Are they actually behaving in a very restrained way on the issue of Taiwan? So these are the things we need to watch.
And just before we finish, I want to give you the opportunity to direct our audience's attention to any work or books, papers, or anything you think they should be looking at of yours or anyone else's.
Well, I've just finished a new book called The Broken China Dream, How Reform Revived Totalitarianism. It's a history, short history of China in the post-Mao era. It's going to be published by Princeton University Press this autumn. I'm very proud of this accomplishment because it gives readers a concise but informative history and try to explain why after 40 years of reform, we have a China locked another generational geopolitical conflict with the US and its domestic economy is slumping and why politics is so depressing in China.
Well, our listeners should definitely look out for that coming out this autumn. It just remains for me to say, Professor Ming Xin Pei, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
It's a pleasure.
Ming Xin Pei is the Tom and Margot Pritzker 72 Professor of Government and George R. Roberts Fellow at Claremont McKenna College. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Ming Xin Pei for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @lse_us, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.